Welcome to SpEducation, the special education podcast by SpEducators and for SpEducators, where we discuss all things related to special education, or as I like to say, SpEducation, from the point of view of professionals working in the field. I'm Sarah Perkins, a nationally certified school psychologist currently practicing in a junior high in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
I'm Leanne McElwain. I'm a special ed teacher at an elementary school and have a background in secondary schools as well.
In this episode, we're going to talk about emotional disability. I guess this would be the first episode of season two because we're going to call that a style intentional choice to have a long break, right?
Love it. Yeah. Yeah. Who doesn't need a long break every year?
I know, right? Exactly. So I was thinking we could do emotional disability for a couple reasons. One was I attended this conference put on by the Wyoming School Psychology Association called How Adverse Childhood Experiences Intersect with Treatment Needs of Aggressive Youth by Tammy Hughes from Duquesne University. And it was really good. And I'm going to use some of the ideas that she referenced, and I'll have a link not to that exact PowerPoint because you had to have attended the conference, but to her information in the show notes. But it just got me thinking about how what we mean by emotional disability and how that's changed over the years, because I feel like it's one of the thorniest disabilities to like relate to.
Definitely.
And I feel like how I've thought about it has changed over the years. And I know, I don't know if this is true in other places, but I feel like in our district, there's definitely this thing that like either don't do that because it's a big thing, or like definitely do that because it's a big thing and opens a lot of doors. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like one extreme or the other.
Right. We had a conversation in my building this last year when we were looking at that category that for eligibility for a student, and we're told that we shouldn't consider it such a big deal because we need to normalize mental health care. And so it was an interesting and kind of contrary opinion to what I had heard before.
Yeah.
But I suppose that can happen with new people coming in and just kind of philosophies changing.
Right.
But prior to that, it really was, you know, that's a very serious category for an eligibility and to really take it seriously.
But yes. And I feel like, especially maybe more so in secondary, but pretty much at all levels, there's this assumption, are they going to be in a program? Are they going to be super isolated? Like, if they're labeled ED, then obviously they're isolated to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least that's on the table.
Right.
Which I don't think should be the case. And I'm hoping maybe we're moving a little bit away from that.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like we at my school have been moving away from that. And like, we have some like quiet girls who, like, their problem is actually that you don't notice them that are labeled ED at my school. And I think that's growth. Because
yeah.
I feel like 10 years ago, we wouldn't have labeled those girls ED.
No, I agree. Very interesting. Yeah.
So it made me think just sort of slowly, not like all of a sudden, but slowly my thoughts about it have been shifting. And like, as you said, as new people come into the system and I interact with them, it's changed my thoughts. And then attending this training. And then, of course, there's the whole like trauma lens. And I've been sort of thinking about for a few years now, is trauma a disability? Is it an emotional disability? Is it that you can't have an emotional disability if you have trauma? Is it that you must have an emotional disability if you have trauma?
Mm-hmm.
So
good questions.
Yeah. So that's why I want to talk about it, because I'm like, this is a thorny topic.
Very good.
So I thought we'd start, just for clarity's sake, with what does the law say? So this is one of the disabilities where Wyoming definition pretty much maps onto the federal definition perfectly. And it says it's a condition, I'm not going to read it because people can read, but happens over a long period of time into a marked degree. And then it has to meet three out of three criteria. And so we'll go through all of them, but the criteria are there's evidence from positive behavioral interventions that the behavior adversely affects their educational performance, which is interesting because it says behavior, not like emotionality.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a box that has multiple boxes underneath, but you only have to check one. And it says they have to exhibit one of the following things, and we'll go through all of those. And then the last one is the social maladjustment clause, which is super sticky, sort of in and of itself. Like, there are whole papers written about social maladjustment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of messy all the way down.
Yeah.
So just starting from the top, I thought we'd talk about that first bullet. So I'll read it verbatim this time so we can sort of talk about it. Documentation from regular education, positive behavioral interventions, evidences that the behavior adversely affects the child's educational performance. In the past, like years ago, mm-hmm. I sort of read this as, does their behavior interfere? Yes or no? Mm-hmm. But lately, I've been reading this more as, do you have documentation that you've tried positive interventions? Because mm-hmm. if not, abort mission.
Right. I would say that as well. Like, you need to have some kind of data, right? That's what it says, mm-hmm. that you're looking at what has worked, what hasn't worked.
I feel like, I think elementary is probably better about this, but I feel like we're not necessarily, as a system, super strong at making sure we have done clear interventions and collected data prior to special education, especially with behavior.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I'd say almost, this sounds like it should be contradictory, but almost especially in the extreme cases. Because if they're like not extreme and maybe, and you have like a behavior support person in your building, they might be sort of working on the edges. But if they're like throwing chairs, then they're referring them to SPED the next day.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. There's that continuum there where we tend to, if it can be dealt with, we kind of deal with it. But that doesn't mean that the child is showing skill growth.
Yeah.
Which is what you're looking, that there would be that skill deficit that you would work on with ED.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so I wrote that ideally it should be, I think best practice would be that I have a graph that I can staple to my report or mm-hmm. to the evaluation document, not my report, because it wouldn't mm-hmm. be my graph, but that our team could staple to the evaluation document saying, yep, here's what we've tried mm-hmm. prior to this meeting. Mm-hmm. And here's how, even with those positive interventions, the behavior continues to be a problem. And if there's been changes in behavior, those changes are too small or insufficient mm-hmm. to say that that's a good enough intervention.
Right.
The other thing that I've been thinking about this past year, and I know that we at my school, and I would argue secondaries, don't do well, is some sort of documentation that, yes, you had a plan, and maybe you collected data, but did anyone, like, on the kid's behavior, which is usually often pretty easy, like, hey, they got a referral. Mm-hmm. Like, the data sort of is generated every time their parents get called, somebody logs it.
Right.
But do you have evidence that the teachers did the thing?
Right.
Because if you could write a plan on March 1st and then say, look, we did the plan all the way through March, and he still called his parents 8 times. Mm-hmm. Well, did you do the plan in that you handed the teachers a piece of paper? Mm-hmm. Or did you do the plan in that the teachers followed that piece of paper every time the kid misbehaved? Like, those are different
right.
definitions of doing the plan.
And you're right to say, like, at the elementary level versus at the secondary, because those are, you can show compliance or, you know, that a plan is being followed much easier at the elementary level. There's fewer adults
right.
involved. Yeah.
It's relatively easy. I mean, relatively. Mm-hmm. Right. I'm not saying it's easy, but relatively easy
right.
to maybe send a parent to the third grade classroom mm-hmm. to say, hey, can you just make sure mm-hmm. that Mrs. Jones, like, gives him his points at the top of the hour
right.
and reminds him what he's working on when he starts to pick up the chair?
Right.
And then just don't say anything to Mrs. Jones. Just report back to me
right.
if she did that.
So much easier.
Whereas, you know, hey, hit those 8 teachers today.
Right. Once every hour.
Once every hour. And then odds are he only throws a chair right. twice a week.
Right.
So you could follow him literally 8 hours and nothing would happen.
Right. Yes.
So I haven't figured out. I've been really thinking about that, which is veering into more behavior planning. But I think what this bullet is showing is that you have to at least started down the behavior planning path mm-hmm. in order to consider this disability.
Yes.
I mean, and I know our district, and I'm assuming everywhere, there's like these weird, what is a behavior plan versus an informal plan versus just an, you know, a chart versus an intervention. But mm-hmm. you have to have done something
mm-hmm.
or you can't check that box.
Right.
That's how I read that. And then the second part of the box is adversely impacts education, which I think this is like often just, well, of course, he's naughty, it adversely impacts his education.
Yeah.
But sometimes I find at elementary, we tend to underemphasize. We're like, well, he only bit me twice and it never broke the skin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then at secondary, we're like, he walks out of class 3 times a day. Mm-hmm. And it's like, which is clearly awful. And I'm like, but he has all A's, but he walks out of class. Well, explain to me again why it's clearly awful. Mm-hmm. If he has
and
all A's.
Adversely yeah. impact.
Who's it a problem for? Does right. it just make you angry to see him in the hallway? Because I'm right. not clear that it's adversely impacting your day.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that that's something that's not always, and then sometimes I think in the elementary we go sort of go the opposite, where we're like, oh, well, it's fine. He's still learning. Mm-hmm. So I haven't really figured out the best way to define that.
Yeah, it can be tricky.
I mean, I think that at this point we're all pretty clear. Obviously, it's not just they can't right. learn good.
Right.
So we know that you can't, like the kid who walks out of class 3 times a day and has all A's. That doesn't mean it's not adversely impacting his education just because he has all A's. Mm-hmm. But you'd have to come up with evidence of it. Mm-hmm. So like, does he have no friends and everybody hates him and people mm-hmm. like are always talking, oh my God, that kid, I hate that kid.
Right. And maybe. What would we, I mean, you would look for kind of that triangulation of data that shows there's multiple areas that are negatively impacted by whatever the behavior is.
Yeah.
Might not be grades, I suppose, depending on how grading is being done.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, I would say if a kid can consistently be out of your class and still have great grades, that's a problem.
There's a question,
but I'm not sure it's a disability question.
Right, right.
And then in the Supreme Court case, Honig versus Doe, they said that you can say a child is disabled due to their inability to conform to socially acceptable norms. So that's recognizing not only like having good friendships, but also just like fitting in.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like if you have a student that continues to undermine a teacher's behavior or other routines within the classroom, mm-hmm. that might be an indication that something more is needed.
Yeah. And to me, I would say that a decent way to define adversely impacts, maybe it's not a perfect way, but a decent way would say, can we identify a goal? Mm-hmm. Like, is there a lagging skill
right.
that we could teach? Mm-hmm. Because if there is, then it probably is adversely. Then one, they're different than other kids in mm-hmm. some way. Mm-hmm. And two, I mean, this isn't really asking about do they need specially designed instruction, but to me they're related. I don't know. Adversely impacts especially. They're not perfectly related, but I feel like there's some correlation.
It there. Indicates need, right?
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the first bullet. So you have to make sure you have your evidence and then make sure you know what it means for the child to be struggling, for them to adversely impact, which both of those are deceptively simple. Mm-hmm. Then it moves into the characteristics where you have to check one of the boxes. Those, I think, are a little bit easier, but I think sometimes we have to make sure that we've thought through the evidence. So the first box is an inability to learn that cannot be explained by intellectual, sensory, or health factors. Mm-hmm. So what I've been doing lately, like when I write up these things, is I will write, the team agrees the child has an inability to learn as evidenced by. Mm. And whether it's standardized test scores, which honestly it's usually not, or just qualitative data, but as long as we have something, mm-hmm. like I could see trauma fitting there.
Yeah.
Like the child is really struggles to engage. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that they are not learning any science.
Right.
Something like that. Mm-hmm. And then I think that you actually would have a fair amount of data towards this, the inability to learn.
I would think so, too. Like, if, I don't know why, but just popped into my head, if you had a student that was sleeping mm. and you couldn't indicate through data or research that there was a medical reason mm-hmm. or, you know, some other reason that explains that away, then that could be something
yeah,
that
it could.
Is indicating.
And even in the secondary, where it's harder to, like, pin teachers down, they would have zeros in their grade book.
Right.
And they'd write, you got a zero on Tuesday because you were sleeping. You got mm-hmm. a zero on Wednesday because you, and so you right. could say, here's my evidence. Mm-hmm.
And we know, I mean, I suppose if you went back to the discussion about the grades, if you had a student that somehow managed, and sometimes there are these students that are so intelligent that they can, when they apply themselves, in 10 minutes finish what the class had done and get an A, you know, definitely master the material. But this student is walking out of class or, you know, is only engaging in work one time a week when they're forced to. That, I mean, those are discussions that can play out that then would indicate like, we probably need some help here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Need some skill growth.
Yeah, and well, I think that one would definitely also play into the next bullet.
Okay.
The inability to build or maintain satisfactory personal interpersonal relationships with peers and teachers. Mm-hmm. So, like, because those are the kids. It's funny because I used to think that, like, the high-performing smart kids were the kids teachers like. And then I had this moment of realization that that's not the case and that despite the fact that I got good grades, maybe I wasn't a likable student.
Yeah.
because I was a bit of a know-it-all.
Uh-huh.
And so, like, that, I think, is something, again, that we could probably get good documentation of.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps, sadly, you're definitely going to get, like, rich data from teachers on this.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Like, because often when I send out, hey, tell me about this student to teachers, I get, like, 30% reply rate.
Mm-hmm.
But on these kids, everybody replies.
Oh,
and they're
yeah.
like, I just can't get to him, and he's always disrespectful, and he rolls his eyes at me, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, you hear about these kids.
Yes.
Or, you know, all the kids are now telling him, can you just stop talking? Because
yeah.
they're done with him.
Right.
You know?
Yep.
So I do think, and this one could also play into that positive behavioral interventions.
Mm-hmm.
Probably that's, you would have data that would overlap with this bullet.
I would think so. Like, or if you don't, maybe you've moved too far ahead.
Yeah.
You know, because it would seem like those are pretty disruptive patterns.
Right.
That somebody would say, we need to be doing something.
I completely agree.
Mm-hmm.
The next one, I don't know. I've been thinking about this one. Inappropriate types of behaviors or feelings under normal circumstances. I've sort of historically thought about this one as like the overreaction
mm-hmm.
and the blowing up, which I think fits perfectly here. Like I have a student at my school mm-hmm. who, you know, this teacher will be like, oh, friend, you didn't get out your book. And he'll be like, F you, F this noise, I'm out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And he storms out and he never comes back. And it's like, yep, that would be an inappropriate type of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But I had another student this year who, she was the sweetest thing, so likable, and she told me things were going great, everything was fine. And then only in the IEP meeting did I find out that she had called her mom 6 times sobbing from the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't supposed to have a cell phone, so she called in the bathroom, called her sobbing, mm-hmm. went to the nurse's office, sobbed for 45 minutes till her mom came to pick her up and went home the rest of the day. And she
six times,
and she'd only been with us 6 weeks because she was a transfer student.
Okay.
And I was like, that's probably something.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
And so it wasn't like an out there behavior. Like, I don't even know that the teachers knew it was happening.
Right.
Because from their perspective, she has to go to the bathroom. She never came back.
Uh-huh.
But once we talked it all out, it was like, oh, that would be an inappropriate. Now, she also had a history. She'd been labeled ED historically. So I felt comfortable with it.
Yeah.
But I think that that's certainly a topic for conversation.
Absolutely. For team members to discuss.
And I remember years ago, we had a kid who would go like borderline catatonic if she
mm-hmm.
got upset.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that? And just would not engage with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't a problem in that she was just present, not engaging.
Mm-hmm.
But I would think that that's probably where I would put that maybe under this bullet too. I mean, it overlaps, of course.
Right.
It would interfere with your relationships.
Mm-hmm.
It would interfere with your learning.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But maybe there?
Yes.
The generally pervasive mood of unhappiness or depression, I think is pretty, like, people know what that is. I think sometimes it can be hard, especially actually elementary.
Mm-hmm. It is. Yes, that question is very hard.
Yeah, because the big ones, like, mine will tell you.
Yeah. Yes. And so there, it's like the team discussing behavior. And then tricky there can also be school versus home.
Mm.
But, you know, obviously those coexist. So it just is, it gets tricky, but you focus mostly on the behaviors that you're seeing. And then the team kind of sifts through to see if it makes sense to use that data to support that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because especially the younger you get, they're not going to tell you mm-hmm. about their, they can sometimes right. tell you about their feelings, mm-hmm. but almost never about their moods.
Yes. And so it's like you really have to dig a little deeper in their behavior and see if you can figure out if like the acting out, maybe pushing a kid or like impulse control mm-hmm. is showing, or lack of impulse control yeah. being something that it can be an indication of irritability
right.
and depression. Like, you know, it's hard.
That is hard.
But you try to collect enough data to figure that out.
Yeah. It just makes me, I feel like we are sort of uncovering a theme of, you just got to make sure you have whoever supports behavior in the school generally mm-hmm. on this team involved, and mm-hmm. and bringing everything they have.
Right. It really needs to be a comprehensive
yeah.
because, eval and look at.
Yeah, because them sitting in my office, mm-hmm. especially if they're 7 years old, mm-hmm. I'm not going to get that. Mm-mm. And even if I go and watch them for 2 hours, mm-hmm. which would be a really long observation, mm-hmm. I might not get that.
Right. And you need the team, like all experts on the team, OT, PT perhaps, or, you know, definitely gen ed teacher, special ed teacher, interventionist, to really know, like, when you consider a behavior, where it's showing up, time of day, you know, so you've got to be able to dig deep. And then, of course, parents to share what they see at home. So
right?
It's hard.
Yeah, it is hard. This next one is one of those that's sort of clear, but sort of hard too. Mm-hmm. Physical symptoms or fears associated with personal or school problems. Like my girl who was crying in the bathroom, that would fit under here too. Mm-hmm. But I do think sometimes when I feel nervous, my stomach hurts. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that that's because I have an emotional disability. Mm-hmm. It's because that's like how it feels to be nervous. Mm-hmm. And also, we do know, I mean, sometimes I think we think of children as more intentionally manipulative than they are, but we do know some kids have learned that if I'm sick, I don't have to go to school. Mm-hmm. And so are they truly feeling sick, developing physical symptoms, mm-hmm. or have they learned a useful tool for school avoidance, which maybe it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Right. Then you have to discuss what, is that avoidance a skill deficit?
Right.
Yeah.
Like, because maybe it's like, okay, whether it's a symptom or fear or just an appropriate type of behavior under normal circumstances, it's still ED.
Yeah.
It's still interfering.
Right. Right.
So, yeah, it could be that. I think sometimes I know because, you know, I love me some paperwork. I can get sort of caught up in like, but we have to check the bullet. And it can be, mm-hmm. well, maybe you don't. Like, maybe it doesn't matter which of those bullets it is.
True.
Like, it may. So I could see a scenario mm-hmm. where we write into the findings that the team agreed that she meets at least one of these criteria. We are unclear if it's just inappropriate behavior or physical symptoms or fear, but we are clear that her avoiding class is substantially interfering with school. Mm-hmm. I think that would be acceptable.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. And then you need to dig deeper with the team to determine how you're.
Yeah. So, yeah. So then what? And then, yeah. And as you go along, I could also see as you go along that perhaps the next year you say, hey, let's reopen that evaluation because we've been collecting data towards her goal mm-hmm. and we've taught her this skill and mm-hmm. we feel confident that she can do the skill. And yet we are still having this problem. So now we have further evidence that it is right. this and not that.
Yes.
Actually, we did that just recently with a student we were evaluating. We all agreed, one, he was diagnosed ADHD, so that made it simple. And we agreed that we were seeing evidence of it at school. Mm-hmm. But when we went to talk about ED, that first bullet, the positive behavioral interventions, we were like, we don't have documentation of that. Mm-hmm. So we agreed he might have an emotional disability, mm-hmm. and we're going to revisit that after we try some things.
Yeah, that seems that seems to make sense. So then, was the disability, did it show up in another area, like other health impairment?
Yeah, so we just did the other health impairment uh-huh. for the ADHD. Uh-huh. And we said he might also have an ED. Uh-huh. And I think we went through the whole checklist, but we said we can't say yes to the first box.
Right.
So we're tentatively sort of holding space for that, uh-huh. and we see needs in that area, uh-huh. that, and they do sort of overlap with the OHI. So we're just going to see what we see.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'd get in trouble, but I think that it was, I mean, it was an honest and forthright discussion that considered the kids' needs.
Right.
So it can't be that off.
Right. I mean, and it was a team decision.
Yeah, so. Exactly, right?
Yeah.
Then we get to the last bullet, which is the social maladjustment bullet. And my understanding about this is that when this law was being written, certain lawmakers really wanted this in here. Mm-hmm. They wanted sort of an out about certain kids shouldn't be included. But nobody ever defined it.
Okay.
So it was this vague term that isn't defined in regulations, and then case law hasn't really defined it either.
Okay.
So it's been sort of assumed to be either that you have circumstances that are causing the problem. So like the example I always say in meetings is like, if your dog died yesterday, mm-hmm. you don't have an emotional disability, you're mm-hmm. grieving.
Yeah.
And so that could be like a social maladjustment. Like you just moved here and you are moved in with your dad who you actually never lived with before, and all your siblings are still back in Texas. And so you're probably not depressed.
Right.
And if you are, like, that's just your adjusting.
Right.
So I guess like adjustment disorder is sort of what I'm saying. Or the other definition has been sort of, I guess, what we'd call antisocial or goal-oriented behavior, where you don't actually, you're not feeling emotional. You're just doing what you're doing to get what you want. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, if you throw a chair, you don't have to be in math class, so you throw a chair.
Right.
But you're not particularly angry. You might act angry.
Yeah. Those are hard to tease out.
Those are really hard to tease out.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it ends up feeling like a little bit like criminalizing children.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, like, when they're younger.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, well, I know that this 7-year-old knows not to call people names, and he just does it anyway.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, do you though? He's 7. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And then we had a discussion, not for a 7-year-old, but 10-year-old, where someone on the team insisted that because there were mental health needs that were showing up in those behaviors, that child should be considered ED.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like, I don't know. I think if there's a rational reason for, and something recent that can, you know, it's not a long-term type of thing that they could go to therapy or see a counselor or see a social worker and can resolve it, then I don't see that as a disability, but
I know
that's why we use the team.
And that, like, I tend to, like, there's, I haven't seen it as much in recent years, but when you and I last worked together, it was a big thing where if a kid got placed with DFS, they request an eval.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be like, this is, and it was always for ED.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be like, this is the exact moment to not evaluate for ED.
Right.
Because you just took the kid away from their home.
Right.
And like, he's probably pissed off. I would be pissed off at the world.
Right.
I think that's a reasonable reaction.
It's a traumatic event. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I'd always tell them, I really don't want to assess for ED. And they'd be like, but we need to. And because he seems disabled. I'm like, of course he seems disabled.
Yeah.
You've ruined his whole life from his perspective.
Right.
So
yeah. Tricky. Okay.
Tricky.
Mm-hmm.
This is a quote from, I believe it's, I put the source in here, but now I don't remember what I said. This is an article about identifying, which I'll link in the show notes, identifying students with emotional disturbance. But they said, special educators face a profound professional development in regard to social maladjustment. In the majority of states, rendering a judgment about special education eligibility often forces them to make a differential diagnosis between serious emotional disturbance and social maladjustment with rather flimsy procedural guidelines, questionable empirical precedent, and frequently incomplete or one-sided case histories.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is true.
Mm-hmm.
It is sort of a rock and a hard place.
Yeah.
So I appreciated, I'm including this article because I appreciated that the author was recognizing, like, this is really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically the best you can do is to try to make ethical decisions.
Yeah.
And keep the best interests of the child centered. Mm-hmm. And I think, and remembering that special education has costs and that not both sides have costs and both sides have advantages.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And then just recognizing, you know, all the parties in play, and like mm-hmm. when there's DFS involved, it changes things. And yeah. like you said, making sure it's a team decision. And I've been moving towards more and more, just like write more about the mm-hmm. conversation. Like this is like the team discussed. Maybe it is social maladjustment, but on the other hand, this, and then on the other hand, that. And finally we concluded the other.
Right.
And just lay it out there. Yeah. So like it's clear that we at least wrestled.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So then there's this conversation of, is social maladjustment, does that mean conduct disorder? Is that, are like, there's like a one-to-one correlation. Should it? And this was one of the things that I learned at that Wyoming School Psychology Association training, or that we talked about, was she talked about conduct disorder, and she said there's sort of a few different types of conduct disorder. Mm-hmm. There's early onset conduct disorder with callous and emotional affect or without callous and emotional affect. And callous and emotional affect is like the bad one.
Mm-hmm.
Callous mm-hmm. and unemotional, did I say that?
Mm-hmm.
So that's like, that's not what you want.
Mm-hmm.
But without that, that can be not so bad. And if you read the definition in DSM, so the criteria are pretty low. And especially if you have the adolescent onset, there's like, it lists like 12 things. So like running away from home and like starting a fire. You do those two things and you qualify.
Mm.
Like once.
Okay.
And you might do those two things the same night because
yeah.
you ran away from home and then you got
and
cold.
You did that. Yeah.
And so like, does that mean that one kid who one time ran away from home and started a campfire
mm-hmm.
is conduct disorder?
Right.
And then the other thing she right. said, which I found, I sort of want to like go tell my colleagues, she's like, adolescent onset, they usually outgrow it. And if they have not had any conduct disorder type behavior until adolescence and then they have it, it's usually just a thing. And then it's fine.
Okay.
By adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was sort of like, don't overreact. Yeah, okay. It's not great
yeah.
that they're like stealing and staying out all night. Like, this is not great.
Uh-huh.
But this is not like sociopath in the making.
Okay.
And I was like, that's really useful to know. And then also, just because, even if it is conduct disorder, just because they have conduct disorder, and even if it is the callous and unemotional, it doesn't necessarily mean they don't also have an emotional disability.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it could, I mean, it could just be that. So
right.
that's like, what a bugaboo,
yeah,
right?
Right.
Which is sort of what you were talking about earlier.
And I used to think that if they, I don't know why, but if they had conduct disorder, then they, it was not then ED. So that is good to know that it does, there's overlap.
I used to think that too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it is good to know that there's overlap. I agree. And I feel like, and I tend to sort of still think like we don't necessarily have to put the conduct disorder type stuff in the IEP.
Yeah.
I guess it would depend. Like if we suspect a lagging skill, we could. Some of that stuff might naturally be hard for the school to intervene. Like if they're running away and stealing cars, sort of hard for us to, assuming they're not doing it on school property, hard for us to interfere with. But if it's that they are stealing from their friends in class
mm-hmm.
and we think that maybe there is a lagging like social skill,
uh-huh.
then
what's the harm in
putting that in there and working on that?
Right, right.
So again, that like child-centered ethical
decision. Yes, and rather than, so you're looking, yeah, like when you say child-centered, looking at what problems are coming up as a related to perhaps that skill development, and why not address that while other things are being addressed,
yeah.
maybe in the community or...
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So then I have in here like trauma. So is trauma social maladjustment? Is it a disability? And I used to think it's social maladjustment because it's circumstantial.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And I sort of think it can be circumstantial, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it could be that trauma causes a disability.
Yeah.
So I think it's depend. Like, I don't think it's necessarily, like, trauma in and of itself isn't a disability.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I think we know that there's
yeah.
more evidence that you're much more likely to have a disability if you've experienced trauma.
Right. And where is the benefit? I think we've just learned a lot more about trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, using that to inform our practices makes sense. And now we can look at it as, what is the harm in providing support for lagging skills that are evident today, even if it is caused by trauma that may not be a long-term thing?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that made sense, but
no, I think it does.
But if you have something you can address today that falls under the category and everybody agrees, it's like, well, let's go ahead and do it.
And then maybe it won't be a lifelong disability.
Right. Right. Because you would never know.
Yeah.
And there is no time requirement within these bullet points that we're trying to meet. It's not like, oh, has this been causing a problem for 3 years?
Well, yeah, it says long period of time, but that's generally assumed to be 6 months.
Yeah.
Which could certainly be, I just moved here from Texas.
Mm-hmm. Right. So in that case, you know, it's always good to rely on team members and for team members to understand the importance of their role. Because in that case, maybe somebody would say, hey, wait, let's make sure we have taught these things.
Right.
And let's revisit
next
year and see.
And it would be ideal if there was some sort of robust tier two supports around behavior and emotions so that you could say, let's make sure we've taught these outside of the special education setting.
Right.
Because I think there is often pressure from families and advocates and sometimes principals. Well, I need them qualified because you're the only people who can deal with him.
Mm-hmm. I have enjoyed working in the school that I'm currently at because we do have a relatively strong tiered system, even for behavior support. So I feel like I could hear my principal, my behavior team, my BIT team saying, hey, wait, this child hasn't received academy support where we have behaviors specifically.
That's awesome.
Addressed, you know, so I could hear my current school team saying, wait, parents, like, we totally get it, but this is what we have in place. Not all schools have that.
No, they do. Well, and I haven't worked, well, I guess I did work at elementary just 3 years ago, but I haven't worked at an elementary that was actively working on that really ever. Mm-hmm. And then secondary is just different. So that's nice to hear that there's, I'm thinking of really not changing, I guess that's too big a word, but like adding to how I do evaluations to make sure that I include trauma, especially because I do work in a Title I school.
Mm-hmm.
And so some changes I'm hoping to make this year is, one, I'm going to work with my social worker to get the parent history done like first, so that we can include that in our conversation, like integrate that more fully into the report. Like, it shouldn't be that everybody's hearing the family history, especially if it's like an out-of-state transfer or an initial and we don't have previous parent histories to look at.
Yeah.
I've also, like, at that training that I went to in the spring, we talked about like trauma questionnaires for parents or kids. Some of them are free. I'll link them. And so I was going to look at those and see about using those. I don't want to antagonize families, but I think that that might be useful.
Mm-hmm.
And the way she shared some examples of how she sort of just wrote about it, and she was pretty like respectful about towards families, just saying, you know, some kids feel traumatized by things that happen in their lives. And when you have trauma, then these things are hard for you.
Mm-hmm.
And if those things are hard for you, you're not going to be successful at school.
Mm-hmm.
And so she said she saw her reports as sort of educational towards the families and potentially educators of the kid.
Yeah.
And so I've been sort of trying to think about how I could incorporate some of that into my writing.
Yeah. So in the building that I work in, this past year we started pre-evaluation meetings with families.
Mm.
And we had, I would say, I'm pretty sure we didn't do a pre-evaluation meeting for every student that needed an eval, but when like a parent was requesting an evaluation, or a teacher had talked to a parent and the parent, you know, and they kind of worked on it together and thought an evaluation would be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
We actually brought representatives from each evaluation area to the table with the parent and said, what is it that, you know, you're thinking needs to be evaluated? Why? What? And yeah. I think that would be a good time, even though, you know, you want to approach it delicately and thoughtfully and respectfully, to say, like, what's happened in this child's past that you're thinking could be related.
So at that, like, meeting where you get the consent for eval started. Yeah, I think you're right. And I know our district has sort of talked about, like, sort of doing family intake information at that time.
Mm-hmm. And, like, you wouldn't have to do all of it.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have to dig deep, but at least everyone would know.
Yeah.
This is the perspective.
And often they'll just lay it out on the table, mm-hmm. which is great. They'll say, well, the reason I'm requesting this eval is because mm-hmm. of this, you know, mm-hmm. his mom just died and, mm-hmm. you know, blah, blah, blah. And so you'll get some of it. But yeah, I think that's a good point. That would be a good time to do it.
And in our building, a lot of times the parents have a good relationship or a trusting relationship with the principal already. And so oftentimes they'll already be connected. We will know either through the social worker or the principal. Usually both of those people know if a parent has been incarcerated or if a parent passed in the last year. Or mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's just kind of a real team effort. Even secretaries, oftentimes those office.
Yeah, they know everything.
Yeah, they'll get information. And then, you know, with a good team, that information is shared and passed along, and then, you know, the team can rally.
It made me think, I'm getting a new social worker this year, and it made me think that maybe one thing I could change is, because we did those meetings last year for the initial.
Okay.
We didn't do them for out-of-states or re-evals, but for initial, mm-hmm. either the school recommending an eval or the parent for the first time, mm-hmm. we held those meetings. Mm-hmm. But it was like me, a principal, and a general educator, and the family. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, I think I might want to let the social worker know, at least know, and then maybe they could hold space available to talk to that parent. One, if the parent comes in, mm-hmm. It might be nice to be respectful of their time and just say, mm-hmm. hey, while you're here, mm-hmm. do you just want to get this one piece out of the way? Mm-hmm. And like, they're a captive audience. Mm-hmm. And two, then they could like meet in person and,
right.
you know, that might work well. And then mm-hmm. I could get the information I need about their background sooner.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a win-win.
Yeah. And it is hard at the secondary level because you have them only, you know, maybe 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of times those trusting relationships are built up with families when they start in kinder and they might have a real issue in third grade. And then, you know, you've known that family, but you don't get that at the secondary.
Yeah, that's sort of a downside and an upside. Because some of those families that you're like, I would not mind if you moved along, they do.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas down, and especially if you're a small elementary in our district where you're like the only resource teacher and you could have the family for 7 glorious years.
Right, yeah.
That's a lot.
Hard.
So then the other thing about the social maladjustment clause is it does say that if social maladjustment is present, but the child meets the criteria, they still qualify. So you have to say that social maladjustment is the sole cause of their difficulties in order to have social maladjustment be the reason they don't meet the criteria.
Yeah.
Which is pretty high standard.
Mm-hmm.
I would have a pretty hard time
ever saying that.
Yeah, off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. I'm like, the only possible circumstances I could see is if they've had a massive life change just now.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you're like, dude, their mom died and they moved across the country
mm-hmm.
a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, I would have, if everybody agrees, it's clearly like conduct disorder. But I just feel like, it'd be really hard to say, mm-hmm. like, the kids, I mean, I'm like, the kids are emotional. Like, normal kids are emotional normally. Mm-hmm. And you're going to say that he's never once been emotional when mm-hmm. he's, I don't know. It'd be hard.
It's really hard. I think what you couple it with is, are there lagging skills?
Mm-hmm.
Is there an area you can clearly address
that
needs specialized instruction, either in behavior or academically? It's like, if it does, then...
Well, and that's the other thing you could do. Mm-hmm. You could fill out all of this and say, yes, they meet the criteria. But then you still have to address, do they need specially designed instruction?
Right.
And it's possible that after all of that, you would say, no, they might need accommodations. I don't think you could fill out the criteria for ED and not say they didn't need at least accommodations because it says adversely impacts education.
Right.
But I think you could say they just need they need a quiet place to go. They need to be able to, you know, meet in with their trusted adult, something like that. But maybe
extended time.
Maybe that's all they need. Or like excusal from, you know, presentations.
Right.
I could see that.
And I could see parents at some point just being, okay, let's start with this level of support. Let's see if they actually can respond with these accommodations in place. And then go from there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else do I have down? Oh, I was thinking about when we sort of covered this already, like how do you, like ways of knowing the answers to these questions. And I think this is one of those examples where like the standardized tools are going to be mostly confirmatory and just the period at the end of a sentence that is full of so much other information. Like a BASC, like, yes, I'm going to give a BASC if I suspect a kid has a disability. A BASC is not sufficient to identify an emotional disability. You'd want that rich parent history. You'd want feedback from the teachers. You'd want behavioral data, right?
Yeah. I paused a little bit because I was thinking about a case where we had very little issue with a student at school, but primarily because very positive, strong supports were in place, those aren't guaranteed from year to year, meaning a good relationship with a teacher. There's the teacher very naturally teaches to lagging skill for individuals, not the whole class. And so it complicated it, and we ended up going with an ED label primarily because other areas were so strong in that seemed to apply to the ED label so strongly, and that classroom didn't.
Oh,
it was just that one
classroom. It was like one safe space?
Yeah, and it was interesting because it's like unstructured areas. Yes, as a building, we had wrapped around that student. We already had those things in place. But those supports aren't typical for every kid. So then we had to say, well, we're actually doing more that would.
Sounds like you were at least already doing a 504 plan at a minimum.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we had to. So it's like it is a great school. If and when people are already working together, sometimes you can have a informal IEP without even having written it.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's a good point. And then is it best for the student to write it or to not? But you do want to make sure you're communicating clearly.
I know.
Yeah. That's a good point. Then the other thing about like the DSM and the ED is that obviously not all mental health diagnoses are emotional disability and vice versa. And it's not our job as schools to diagnose with this particular emotional disability, which I think gives us, I find to be useful because it can grant the team and the parents some grace. And in terms of, you know, we're not necessarily labeling your kid depressed or, I don't know, anxious or any of those things, but we're saying that we're seeing these behaviors and these lagging skills and these difficulties. I think there's some DSM diagnoses that would make, that would probably not fit under this category. And the ones that come to mind most strongly to me are like personality disorders. But luckily, personality disorders aren't really a kid problem. So I think it's unlikely to come up super frequently, although I had a child diagnosed with a personality disorder from an outside provider. We ended up labeling him other health impairment, ADHD, which was fine.
That's what I was thinking is that there, it would, the very fact that you're, there's contemplation around that student, it would make sense that if the, if it's to that level, to that degree, you would find another area to to identify, to address.
Yeah.
And then, but then it's challenging because it feels to me, and maybe because of the realm that we're in, special education in and of itself, but I just feel like so many kids could qualify.
Yeah, I think they could.
I mean, almost every student could really qualify.
Right? And that's where I think we have to go back to the specially designed instruction. Because yeah. I am certain that at my junior high of 600 kids, there are probably a minimum of 200 kids who would meet a DSM diagnosis, mm-hmm. especially for depression or anxiety or those sort of high flyer ones, right?
Right.
And we only have like 130 kids on IEPs total.
Yeah.
So obviously all of those kids are not on IEPs. So either that's a failure of the system to identify, which I'm sure applies to some of them, especially those quiet girls, because mm-hmm. we all know the quiet mm-hmm. girls slip the cracks. But I think also it's an acknowledgement that, you know, being a human's hard.
Yes.
And you can have hard things mm-hmm. in your life mm-hmm. and you're working on them. And that's enough. The fact that you and your family and maybe your teachers are working on them right. is enough.
And I think it speaks to the importance of a robust tier one, mm-hmm. robust tier two, and then knowing, because life is hard. And
and
many things do happen to us that create extra need for support. Then we go back to that specialized instruction and a significant amount of time.
And,
yeah.
I do wish we had more tier one support on, and I know we've sort of like dabbled in it as a district, like when we got COVID money, but like on emotional regulation.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was thinking, you know, I always use the example, like if your dog died and it's like, well, most kids have pets and the bummer mm-hmm. about pets is they have short lifespans.
Mm-hmm.
So like it would be reasonable to have a group lesson about it's really hard
mm-hmm.
when your pets die.
Yeah. Yes.
And like,
kind of last year had an informal lesson on that when a student came in and said their dog had passed and then another student said, I have had that too. And I actually was so pleased because one of the students I had said, I'm so sorry. That sounds very sad. You know, and they weekly have peace circles where they can talk about
those
things.
Lovely.
So yeah, I do think there's something to be said for some prior teaching.
Right.
For what life has.
Well, and then at like secondary, the whole, you know, like, I think I probably on a weekly basis talk about, friends change when you get to junior high. It's mm-hmm. weird, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And like they used to be fine, but now they're too busy being cool. And that's hard. That hurts your heart.
Right.
You know? Like those kinds of conversations.
Really normalizing.
Yeah. Like that is a normal conversation. Mm-hmm. I mean, I happen to be having it with a sped kid because they're in my office.
Right.
But it doesn't take me
right.
to have, like,
right.
I'm certain all 600 of our students have mm-hmm. experienced that because that's mm-hmm. part of growing up.
Exactly. Yeah.
So interesting. So, mm-hmm. yeah. So maybe we'll talk about some other disabilities down the road that are interesting, like maybe autism.
Mm-hmm.
But.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Education.